A bad day. Peter sat in the box of the open carriage next to the coachman. He was not particularly fond of that seat, but the coachman and everybody at home thought he liked it extremely, and he, on his part, did not want to hurt people. So this is how he came to be sitting there, a sallow-faced, gray-eyed youngster in a smart sailor blouse. The pair of well-fed black horses with a gloss in their fat croups and something extraordinarily feminine about their long manes kept lashing their tails in sumptuous fashion as they progressed at a rippling trot, and it pained one to observe how avidly, despite that movement of tails and that twitching of tender ears, despite too the thick tarry odor of the repellent in use, dull gray deer flies or some big gadfly with shimmery eyes bulging would stick to the sleek coats. Coachman Stepan, a taciturn elderly man wearing a sleeveless vest of black velvet over a crimson Russian shirt, had a dyed beard and a brown neck lined with thin cracks. Peter felt embarrassed to keep silent while sitting on the same box. Therefore he fixed his gaze on the middle shaft, on the traces, trying to invent a keen question or a sound remark. From time to time this or that horse would half raise its tail, under the tensed root of which a bulb of flesh would swell, squeezing out one tawny globe, then another, a third, after which the folds of black skin would close again, and the tail droop. In the Victoria sat with her legs crossed Peter's sister, a dark-complexioned young lady. Although only 19, she had already divorced one husband. In a bright frock, high-laced white boots with glistening black caps, and a wide-brimmed hat that cast a lacy shadow upon her face. Ever since morning she had been in a vile temper, and now, when Peter turned to her for the third time, she directed at him the point of her iridescent parasol and said, "Stop fidgeting, please!" The first part of the way went through the woods. Splendid clouds gliding across the blue only increased the glitter and vivacity of the summer day. If one looked from below at the tops of the birches, their verdure reminded one of sun-soaked, translucent grapes. On both sides of the road, bushes exposed the pale underside of their leaves to the hot wind. Shine and shade speckled the depths of the forest. One could not separate the pattern of tree trunks from that of their interspaces. Here and there a patch of moss flashed its heavenly emerald. Floppy ferns ran past, almost brushing against the wheels. There appeared in front a great wagon of hay, a greenish mountain flecked with tremulous light. Stepan reined in his steeds. The mountain inclined over to one side, the carriage to the other. There was barely enough room to pass on the narrow forest road, and one caught a tangy whiff of new-mown fields, and the ponderous creak of cartwheels, and a glimpse of wilted scabiouses and daisies amid the hay. And then Stepan clicked his tongue, gave a shake to his reins, and the wagon was left behind. Presently the woods parted, the Victoria turned onto the highway, and farther came harvested fields, the stridulation of grasshoppers in the ditches, and the humming of telegraph poles. In a moment the village of Voskresensk would show up, and a few minutes later it would be the end. Plead sickness? Topple down from the box? Glumly wondered Peter as the first izbaz appeared. His tightish white shorts hurt in the crotch. His brown shoes pinched dreadfully. He felt nasty qualms in his stomach. The afternoon awaiting him was oppressive, repulsive, and inevitable. They were now driving through the village, and somewhere from behind the fences and log cabins a wooden echo responded to the harmonious plashing of hooves. On the clayey, grass-patched side of the road, peasant boys were playing gorodki, pitching stout sticks at wooden pins which resoundingly flew up in the air. Peter recognized the stuffed hawk and silvered spheres that ornamented the garden of the local grocer. A dog dashed out of a gateway, in perfect silence, storing up voice, as it were, and only after flying across the ditch and finally overtaking the carriage did it peal forth its bark. Shakily straddling a shaggy nag, a peasant rode by, his elbows widely parted, his shirt, with a tear on the shoulder, ballooning in the wind. At the end of the village, on a hillock thickly crested with limes, stood a red church, and, next to it, a smaller mausoleum of white stone and pyramidal shape, thus resembling a cream pashka. The river came into view, with the green brocade of aquatic flora coating it at the bend. Close to the sloping highway stood a squat smithy, on the wall of which someone had chalked, "Long live Serbia!" The sound of the hooves suddenly acquired a ringing, resilient tone, because of the boards of the bridge over which the carriage passed. A barefoot old angler stood leaning against the railing. A tin receptacle gleamed at his ankle. Presently the sound of the hooves turned to a soft thudding. The bridge, the fisherman, and the river bend dropped back irremediably. The Victoria was now rolling along a dusty, fluffy road between two rows of stout-trunked birches. In an instant, yes, in an instant, from behind its park, the green roof of the Kozlovs' manor house would loom. Peter knew by experience how awkward and revolting it would be. He was ready to give away his new swift bicycle. And what else in the bargain? Well, the steel bow, say, and the Pugach pistol, and all its supply of powder-stuffed corks, in order to be back again in the ancestral domain 10 versts from here, and to spend the summer day, as always, in solitary, marvelous games. From the park came a dark, damp reek of mushrooms and furs. Then appeared a corner of the house and the brick-red sand in front of the stone porch. "The children are in the garden," said Mrs. Kozlov, when Peter and his sister, having traversed several cool rooms redolent of carnations, reached the main veranda where a number of grown-ups were assembled. Peter said, "How do you do?" to each, scraping and making sure not to kiss a man's hand by mistake, as had once happened. His sister kept her palm on the top of his head, something she never did at home. Then she settled in a wicker armchair and became unusually animated. Everybody started talking at once. Mrs. Kozlov took Peter by the wrist, led him down a short flight of steps between tubbed laurels and oleanders, and with an air of mystery pointed gardenward. "You will find them there," she said. "Go and join them." Whereupon she returned to her guest. Peter remained standing on the lower step. A rotten beginning. He now had to walk across the garden terrace and penetrate into an avenue where, in spotted sunshine, voices throbbed and colors flickered. One had to accomplish that journey all alone, coming ever nearer, endlessly nearer, while entering gradually the visual field of many eyes. It was the name day of Mrs. Kozlov's eldest son, Vladimir, a lively and teasy lad of Peter's age. There was also Vladimir's brother, Konstantin, and their two sisters, Baby and Lola. From the adjacent estate, a pony-drawn Sherebanchik brought the two young barons, Korf and their sister Tanya, a pretty girl of 11 or 12 with an ivory-pale skin, bluish shadows under the eyes, and a black braid caught by a white bow above her delicate neck. In addition, there were three schoolboys in their summer uniforms, and Vasily Tuchkov, a robust, well-built, suntanned 13-year-old cousin of Peter's. The games were directed by Elyensky, a university student, the tutor of the Kozlov boys. He was a fleshy, plump-chested young man with a shaven head. He wore a kosovarotka, a shirt-like affair with side buttons on the collarbone. A rimless pince-nez surmounted his nose, whose chiseled sharpness did not suit at all the soft ovality of his face. When finally Peter approached, he found Elyensky and the children in the act of throwing javelins at a large target of painted straw nailed to a fir trunk. Peter's last visit to the Kozlovs had been in St. Petersburg at Easter, and on that occasion magic lantern slides had been shown. Elyensky read aloud Lermontov's poem about Mitsiri, a young monk who left his Caucasian retreat to roam among the mountains, and a fellow student handled the lantern. In the middle of a luminous circle on the damp sheet, there would appear, stopping there after a spasmodic incursion, a colored picture. Mitsiri and the snow leopard attacking him. Elyensky, interrupting the reading for a minute, would point out with a short stick first the young monk and then the leaping leopard, and as he did so, the stick borrowed the picture's colors, which would then slip off his wand when Elyensky removed it. Each illustration tarried for quite a time on the sheet, as only some 10 slides were assigned to the long-winded epic. Vasily Tuchkov now and then raised his hand in the dark, reached up to the ray, and 5 black fingers spread out on the sheet. Once or twice the assistant inserted a slide the wrong way, topsy-turvying the picture. Tuchkov roared with laughter, but Peter was embarrassed for the assistant, and in general did his best to feign enormous interest. That time, too, he first met Tanya Korf, and since then often thought about her, imagining himself saving her from highwaymen, with Vasily Tuchkov helping him and devotedly admiring his courage. It was rumored that Vasily had a real revolver at home, with a mother-of-pearl grip. At present, his brown legs set wide, his left hand loosely placed on the chainlet of his cloth belt, which had a small canvas purse on one side, Vasily was aiming the javelin at the target. He swung back his throwing arm, he hit the bullseye, and Olensky uttered a loud, "Bravo!" Peter carefully pulled out the spear, quietly walked back to Vasily's former position, quietly took aim, and also hit the white, red-ringed center. No one, however, witnessed this, as the competition was over by now, and busy preparations for another game had begun. A kind of low cabinet or whatnot had been dragged into the avenue and set up there on the sand. Its top had several round holes and a fat frog of metal with a wide-open mouth. A large leaden counter had to be cast in such a way as to pop into one of the holes or enter the gaping green mouth. The counter fell through the holes of the mouth into numbered compartments on the shelves below. The frog's mouth gave one 500 points, each of the other holes 100 or less, depending on its distance from La Grande Vie. A Swiss governess had imported the game. The players took turns in throwing one by one several counters, and marks were laboriously written down on the sand. The whole affair was rather tedious, and between turns some of the players sought the bilberry jungle under the trees of the park. The berries were big, with a bloom dimming their blue, which revealed a bright violet luster if touched by beslavered fingers. Peter, squatting on his haunches and gently grunting, would accumulate the berries in his cupped hand, and then transfer the entire handful to his mouth. That way it tasted particularly good. Sometimes a serrate little leaf got mixed up in one's mouth with the fruit. Vasily Tuchkov found a small caterpillar with varicolored tufts of hair along its back in toothbrush arrangement, and calmly swallowed it to the general admiration. A woodpecker was tapping nearby. Heavy bumblebees droned above the undergrowth and crawled into the pale bending corollas of boyar bellflowers. From the avenue came the clatter of cast counters and the stentorian R-trilling voice of Olensky, advising somebody to keep trying. Tanya crouched next to Peter, and with her pale face expressing the greatest attention, her glistening purple lips parted, groped for the berries. Peter silently offered her his hand-cupped collection. She graciously accepted it, and he started to gather a new helping for her. Presently, however, came her turn to play, and she ran back to the avenue, lifting high her slim legs in white stockings. Their Grand Vie game was becoming a universal bore. Some dropped out, others played haphazardly. As to Vasily Tuchkov, he went and hurled a stone at the gaping frog, and everybody laughed, except Olensky and Peter. The Imeninnik, named Dayer, handsome, charming Mary Vladimir, now demanded that they play at Palochka Stukalochka, knock-knock stick. The Korf boys joined in his request. Tanya skipped on one foot, applauding. "No, no, children, impossible," said Olensky. "In half an hour or so we shall go to a picnic. It is a long drive, and colds are caught quickly if one is all hot from running." "Oh, please, please," cried the children. "Please?" softly repeated Peter after the others, deciding he would manage to share a hiding place either with Vasily or Tanya. "I am forced to grant the general request," said Olensky, who was prone to round out his utterings. "I do not see, however, the necessary implement." Vladimir sped off to borrow it from a flower bed. Peter went up to a seesaw on which stood Tanya, Lola, and Vasily. The ladder kept jumping and stamping, making the plank creak and jerk while the girls squealed, trying to keep their balance. "I'm falling! I'm falling!" exclaimed Tanya, and both she and Lola jumped down on the grass. "Would you like some more bilberries?" asked Peter. She shook her head, then looked askance at Lola, and turning to Peter again added, "She and I have decided to stop speaking to you."
"But why?"
mumbled Peter, flushing painfully.
"Because you are a poseur," replied
Tanya, and jumped back onto the seesaw. Peter pretended to be deeply engrossed in the examination of a frizzly black molehill on the edge of the avenue. In the meantime, a panting Vladimir had brought the necessary implement, a green, sharp little stick of the sort used by gardeners to prop up peonies and dahlias, but also very much like Elensky's wand at the Magic Lantern Show. It remained to be settled who would be the knocker.
"One, two, three, four,"
began Elensky in a comic narrative tone, while pointing the stick at every player in turn.
"The rabbit peeped out of his door. A hunter, alas,"
Elensky paused and sneezed powerfully,
"happened to pass,"
the narrator replaced his pince-nez,
"and his gun went bang, bang, and the poor,"
the syllables grew more and more stressed and spaced,
"hare died there."
The "there" fell on Peter, but all the other children crowded around Elensky, clamoring for him to be the seeker. One could hear them exclaiming,
"Please, please, it will be much more fun."
"All right, I consent," replied Elensky, without even glancing at Peter.
At the point where the avenue joined the garden terrace, there stood a whitewashed, partly peeled bench with a barred back, also white and also peeling. It was on this bench that Elensky sat down with the green stick in his hands. He humped his fat shoulders, closed his eyes tight, and started to count aloud to 100, giving time for the players to hide. Vasily and Tanya, as if acting in collusion, disappeared in the depths of the park. One of the uniformed schoolboys cannily placed himself behind a linden trunk, only 3 yards away from the bench. Peter, after a wistful glance at the speckled shade of the shrubbery, turned away and went in the opposite direction, toward the house. He planned to ambuscade on the veranda. Not on the main one, of course, where the grown-ups were having tea to the sound of a brass-horned gramophone singing in Italian, but on a lateral porch giving on Elensky's bench. Luckily, it turned out to be empty. The various colors of the panes inset in its latticed casements were reflected beneath on the long, narrow divans, upholstered in dove gray with exaggerated roses that lined the walls. There were also a bentwood rocking chair, a dog's bowl licked clean on the floor, and an oilcloth-covered table with nothing upon it save a lone-looking pair of old-person spectacles. Peter crept up on the many-colored window and kneeled on a cushion under the white ledge. At some distance, one saw a coral-pink Elensky sitting on a coral-pink bench under the ruby-black leaves of a linden. The rule was that the seeker, when leaving his post to spy out the concealed players, should also leave his stick behind. Wariness and nice judgment of pace and place advised him not to stray too far, lest the player made a sudden dash from an unsighted point and reach the bench before the seeker could get back to it and give a rap of victory with the regained wand. Peter's plan was simple. As soon as Elensky, having finished counting, put the stick down on the bench and set off toward the shrubbery with its most likely lurking spots, Peter would sprint from his veranda to the bench and give it the sacramental knock-knock with the unguarded stick. About half a minute had already elapsed. A light blue Elensky sat hunched up under indigo-black foliage and tapped his toe on the silver-blue sand in rhythm with the count. How delightful it would have been to wait thus, and peer through this or that lozenge of stained glass, if only Tanya... Oh, why? What did I do to her? The number of plain glass panes was much inferior to that of the rest. A gray and white wagtail walked past across the sand-colored sand. There were bits of cobweb in the corners of the latticework.
On the ledge, a dead fly lay on its back. A bright yellow Ilyinsky rose from his golden bench and gave a warning knock. At the same instant, the door leading onto the veranda from the inside of the house opened, and out of the dusk of a room there came first a corpulent brown dachshund, and then a gray bob-haired little old woman in a tight-belted black dress with a trefoil-shaped brooch on her chest and a chainlet around her neck, connecting with the watch stuck into her belt. Very indolently, sideways, the dog descended the steps into the garden. As to the old lady, she angrily snatched up the spectacles for which she had come. All of a sudden she noticed the boy crawling off his seat. Priyatki! 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 Hide and seek! She uttered with the farcical accent inflicted on Russian by old Frenchwomen after half a century of life in our country. Tut ne khorosh, tut ne khoroshua, hear not good. She continued, considering with kindly eyes Peter's face that expressed both embarrassment with his situation and entreaty not to speak too loud. Сейчас покажу хорош мест, сейчас покажу хорошее место. Right away I'll show a good place. An emerald Ilyinsky stood with arms akimbo on the pale green sand and kept glancing in all directions at once. Peter, fearing the creaky and fussy voice of the old governess might be heard outside and fearing even more to offend her by a refusal, hastened to follow her, though quite conscious of the ludicrous turn things were taking. Holding him firmly by the hand, she led him through one room after another, past a white piano, past a card table, past a little tricycle. And as the variety of sudden objects increased, elk antlers, bookcases, a decoy duck on a shelf, he felt she was taking him to the opposite side of the house and making it more and more difficult to explain, without hurting her, that the game she had interrupted was not so much a matter of hiding as of awaiting the moment when Ilyinsky would retreat sufficiently far from the bench to allow one to run to it and knock upon it with the all-important stick. After passing through a succession of rooms, they turned into a corridor, then went up a flight of stairs, then traversed a sunlit mango room where a rosy-cheeked woman sat knitting on a trunk near the window. She looked up, smiled, and lowered her lashes again, her knitting needles never stopping. The old governess led Peter into the next room, where stood a leathern couch and an empty bird's cage, and where there was a dark niche between a huge mahogany wardrobe and a Dutch stove.
What?
Here you are, said the old lady, and having pressed him with a light push into that hiding place, went back to the mangle room, where in her garbled Russian she continued a gossipy conversation with the comely knitter, who kept inserting every now and then an automatic Skazitsia Poljalutska. Well, I never. For a while Peter remained kneeling politely in his absurd nook. Presently he straightened up, but continued standing there and peering at the wallpaper with its blandly indifferent azure scroll, at the window, at the top of a poplar rippling in the sun. One could hear a clock hoarsely tick-tocking, and that sound reminded one of various dull and sad things. A lot of time passed. The conversation in the next room began to move away and to lose itself in the distance. Now all was silent except the clock. Peter emerged from his niche. He ran down the stairs, tiptoed rapidly through the rooms, bookcases, elk horns, tricycle, blue card table, piano, and was met at the open door leading to the veranda by a pattern of colored sun and by the old dog returning from the garden. Peter stole up to the window panes and chose an unstained one. On the white bench lay the green wand. Ilyinsky was invisible. He had walked off, no doubt, in his unwary search, far beyond the lindens that lined the avenue. Grinning from sheer excitement, Peter skipped down the steps and rushed toward the bench. He was still running when he noted an odd irresponsiveness around him. However, at the same swift pace he reached the bench and knocked on its seat thrice with the stick. A vain gesture. Nobody appeared. Flecks of sunlight pulsated on the sand. A ladybird was walking up a bench arm, the transparent tips of her carelessly folded wings showing untidily from under her small spotted cupola. Peter waited for a minute or two, stealing glances around, and finally realized that he had been forgotten, that the existence of a last unfound, unflushed lurker had been overlooked, and that everybody had gone to the picnic without him. That picnic, incidentally, had been for him the only acceptable promise of the day. He had been looking forward after a fashion to it, to the absence of grown-ups there, to the fire built in a forest clearing, to the baked potatoes, to the bilberry tarts, to the iced tea in thermos bottles. The picnic was now snatched away. But one could reconcile oneself to that privation. What rankled was something else. Peter swallowed hard, and still holding the green stick, wandered back to the house. Uncles, aunts, and their friends were playing cards on the main veranda. He distinguished the sound of his sister's laughter, a nasty sound. He walked around the mansion with the vague thought that somewhere near it there must be a lily pond, and that he might leave on its brink his monogrammed handkerchief and his silver whistle on its white cord, while he himself would go, unnoticed, all the way home. Suddenly, near the pump, behind a corner of the house, he heard a familiar burst of voices. All were there. Elyensky, Vasily, Tanya, her brothers and cousins. They clustered around a peasant who was showing a baby owl he had just found. The owlet, a fat little thing, brown, white-speckled, kept shifting this way and that its head, or rather its facial disc, for one could not make out exactly where the head started and the body stopped. Peter approached. Vasily Tuchkov glanced at him and said to Tanya with a chuckle, "And here comes the poseur."